Welcome to the You Catastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel, he's Dave. We're back again and talking about enchantment for a moment here. I had one of those rare moments where my friend David here, who loves spoilers, he gave me a good emotional spoiler this time and told me that Spider-Man is back in the MCU.
Oh, no, he's out again.
That's just...
It's not
just
true.
Just don't even toy with my emotions like that. And the other thing I got to do was I watched Legion, which was catching up so that David couldn't spoil that either. And yeah, so I thought maybe one day we should do an episode on Legion.
Yeah, bonus episode.
Yeah, because no one will listen to it.
Yeah. Everyone just watch Legion.
Yeah, you really should.
For goodness sake.
You really should.
It's kind of based on comic books, but you don't need to worry about that even if you're not.
Yeah. And it's like, if you're interested in what John Paul II would call structures of sin.
It has a lot to say about the nature of human wickedness and the possibility of redemption.
Yes.
Imagine if Wes Anderson had a child with David Lynch and that child produced a comic book movie. That's what it's like.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And it was part musical.
Yeah.
And had Kiwi actors doing rap battles.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds better than...
No, it's actually really good. Yeah. No, people should watch it. Yeah. But we are... So it's fascinating to me because we have this slight tension because we are people who really enjoy things that Disney gives us.
That's right. Oh, dear.
And yet, what are we talking about today, David?
Today, I want to continue on with our theme of just discussing books, basically, to talk about William Cavanaugh's wonderful book, Being Consumed, which is a book that I've returned to just recently in preparation for this podcast. But it's a book that's had a huge impact on my thinking. And I know I think I've probably referenced the ideas in it numerous times in different episodes without citing it, I imagine. So I thoroughly recommend reading the book, but we'll give you a bit of an overview here. The reason I wanted to talk about consumerism and the idea of consumerism as a way of constructing public life that in turn impacts and shapes our souls and affections and things like that. There was a couple of things that kind of came up for me that made me want to do this. Firstly, was the lectionary readings for the last couple of weeks. So the lectionary, if your church follows lectionary, you might notice that the kind of theme of the different readings has been about wealth. So 2 weeks ago from the recording of this podcast, the reading was that bizarre passage that no one's properly explained to me ever about the shrewd manager. But it finishes with that famous saying that no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate one and love the other. You'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money, which is from Luke chapter 16, verse 13. Last Sunday was the famous parable of the rich man and Lazarus. So Lazarus being a beggar who had a disability and a skin disease living outside a rich person's place. The Lazarus dies and goes to heaven. The rich person dies and goes to hell and begs Lazarus to help him. Now, the thing that I noticed, that I always notice whenever these passages are talked on in churches that I go to, not every single time, but quite uniformly, there'll be some version of course we know that money's not really the problem, it's greed.
Or just whatever you place as a pursuit instead of Christ.
But for some reason it just struck me this last couple of weeks that what if it's not? Like what if we're getting it backwards? What if money itself is actually the problem and it's generation of greed? Because Christ doesn't say where your heart is, there your treasure will be. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. It seems that the objects of our desire, the things that we value, shape our characters and produce greed. So that's one part. I think the church, especially my kind of church, bougie, Anglican churches are pretty terrible at actually critiquing economic structures. The other one was just, it dawned on me a few observations that I've had of rich people lately.
Where were you?
No,
sitting on the.
I say over the last couple of years,
I was in the Hamptons, and I was just observing rich people.
Just interactions I've had in passing with quite wealthy people, and observing some very strange behaviours. In a way, I was reminded of young people that I worked with as a youth worker who came from a background of neglect, where there was a constant concern that they would somehow all of a sudden be left with nothing. Mm. A deep anxiety that their primary reality was scarcity, that they had to hold on and accumulate more. There was a fixation in their conversation and language on their amount of wealth. And also talking to another friend who did some kind of administrative support for a couple of very, very wealthy people, he was talking about this what I call financial dysmorphia, this complete misunderstanding of the reality of their financial well-being. They consider themselves as being poor because they don't have as much money as their richest friend. And it's a type of kind of insanity.
So what generates that?
I think it's the power of money itself. Mm. And this is why I don't think it's sufficient to say, well, it's all just about your character. Money's not the problem. Or, you know, owning 10 houses isn't the problem. It's what you do with them. Or it's your attitude towards them. Mm. I think wealth actually is morally formative, and it can create a epistemological and moral crisis for you. Mm. Epistemological in the sense that there's numerous studies. The book Affluenza is a great thing to look at here, that show just the lack of reality experienced by people who have extreme amount of wealth on both their understanding of the day-to-day of experience of people who have less wealth, but also a lack of things like empathy and things like that. Now, that's not to say that wealthy people will necessarily be like this, but it does seem to indicate that wealth does shape.
That's interesting. It's almost like you're suggesting a metaphysics of wealth, right? So yes. We talk about God illuminates.
Yeah.
So we pursue God and God actually becomes our own sight.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that wealth becomes almost the sight, the thing that illuminates a person's, you said, epistemology.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's what provides people with literally their values. Mm. It shapes the things that are worth pursuing in people's minds. And it produces an incredible amount of anxiety. And we live in an economy that is based on people's anxiety that there is not enough to go around and I have to do whatever it takes to grab my piece of the earth. But that's the kind of background. These are all the kind of thoughts and experiences that I've had recently and kind of gone, oh, yeah, we really need to talk about this a bit. And I was reminded of Kavanaugh's wonderful book. Now, Kavanaugh has kind of basically four points that he has to say about consumerism, particularly consumerism as an alternative to true religion. And he sees it as an alternative in kind of four ways. He says, first of all, it provides an alternative conception of freedom, particularly freedom and its relationship to human desire. Consumerism is about uncoupling desire from any particular ends. Desire itself becomes the end of the consumerist society and the desire to continue desiring, which leads to a kind of another critique, a second critique, which he sees as a kind of a Gnostic degradation of the material. So he rejects this idea that consumerism is about fundamentally greed. He would distinguish between those things because greed is an unhealthy attachment to objects. But he sees consumerism as actually problematizing that relationship between the objects of our desires, because consumerism is actually about a lack of attachment to our objects. We disregard the material. The actual pursuit, the shopping experience is the center of the consumer society. It's not the obtaining of the object. And quite frequently, the objects of our desires are things that we'll discard in a week or so as well. And this kind of operates on a macro level where we create a kind of whole world. Think back to our kind of non-place episode, whatever that one was called, where we talked about Notre Dame Cathedral. We create a world of where all spaces, all objects are fungible. And so we don't actually desire objects. We desire to desire something. Thirdly, he says that it provides I don't know if he uses this term, but I'll call it a false Catholicity. So the Catholic Church being the attempt to generate unity and diversity across time and geography. Consumerism offers an alternative to this, but it's a diversity in the name of choice, which ends up creating these congregates or conglomerates that form monopolies, which end up generating less choice and generate more sameness. And so all over the world, we go to the same, we go to different countries, different continents, and the shopping malls look exactly the same.
That's what Charles Taylor calls mutual displays of identity.
Yes, yeah.
That are marshaled by corporate interests.
Yes, and then finally, he sees it as being an alternative to the Eucharist, because in the Eucharist, we see a person who is rather than being empty and needing to be filled up, who is full and overflows and feeds us of his very abundance. And in participating in his body and blood, we ourselves are consumed and transformed in our character and freed up from our fear of scarcity in order to love our brothers and sisters. So that's the Eucharistic image. But the consumerist image is this underlying principle of all of our public affairs, that we are fundamentally creatures in competition experiencing resource scarcity. And so motivated self-interest is our only saving grace, that in competition, in pursuit of our own individual ends, our own desires, we can kind of corner our little bit of the material that is available to be consumed. Mm. So there's a lot there, but I want to talk mainly, I've talked about this at length on other episodes, particularly I think part of our cultural Marxism episode as well. But thinking about the first point, this idea that freedom in a consumerist model is an alternate to a Christian understanding of freedom. So I've said this a bajillion times, but from what I understand of a Christian conception of freedom, freedom for someone like Augustine is the capacity to pursue our objective and true ends and to have our desires shaped towards the pursuit of these things.
To not be controlled by one's passions, for example.
Yes.
So he has this, Augustine has this line when he's, I think he's running, maybe in respect to the Donatists, but he says, how, if they are slaves of sin, can they boast freedom of choice?
Yeah.
Right. And the same sort of thing is here, right?
Yeah.
If you are perversely oriented towards these consumer goods, as you're describing, or the end of wealth,
yes,
then how can you say that is freedom of choice when you are subject to a slave to sin or rightly or wrongly ordered desire?
Yeah. Or he would talk about it as an empty throne. So all desires, if our kind of soul is orientated rightly, all our desires kind of culminate and point towards our ultimate desire, which is for union with God. Mm. And all other objects are instruments for the pursuit of that ultimate union with God. And whenever a object within the world is treated as a final end in itself, we have a distortion of our desires and a disorder of the soul. Mm. Religion, true religion, means orienting the desires rightly to be pointing towards that final goal.
Or the gospel according to John says, the truth will set you free.
Yes.
Right.
But in the consumerist society, desire itself becomes the thing on sale. So Kavanaugh talks about how if we look at advertising from ages gone by, it used to be about the provision of information. So you'd have someone standing in as a representation of expertise. So someone in a lab coat, for example, and they would tell you that you should buy this toothpaste, for example, because it has X, Y, and Z property and X number of dentists suggest it, information providing. But what is advertising today? Today, advertising is the creation of associations that evoke desire. Desire not necessarily for the object that is being advertised even, just desire generally. Mm. So if you think about car ads, razor ads, and things like that, they have nothing to do with the product. They are touching into an empty, endless longing that's within us that we learn, are trained to associate with the product. So hopefully this point is making sense, but the object itself is not what's on sale.
Yeah, so I think that, can I just pick up on two points here? One is that conception of freedom and then where it leads.
Yeah.
And then the second is what you're saying about it promoting desire itself.
Mm.
Now, on the first, it's fascinating in Kavanaugh's work, for example, because he talks about that it stimulates desire as the end of the economy itself, right? Because your point is not to rest in any good.
Yeah.
It's actually you are to be restless and go for new goods and so on. But and there's a shift, there's an interesting parallel shift in the papal thinking around this as well. So John Paul II and Pope Benedict would talk about infinite freedom, you know, was based around a relativization of truth, right? Without an understanding of one's objective ends, then people would pursue multiple ends and this was a problem. Whereas Pope Francis, and this is something that Kavanaugh is picking up now in recent work, Pope Francis talks more about how that conception of freedom doesn't leave open a field of infinite choice and so on. And it's not just about relativization of truth, but it is housed by idols. And the idea here being that the world is not drained of religion.
Yes.
Rather, what we have cultivated are various forms of false religion.
Yeah.
Or various forms of idolatry. And so in his various encyclicals, Laudato Si, Evangelii Gaudium, and Lumen Fidei, Pope Francis talks at length about this, that this is actually people engaged in these pursuits, engaging in religious pursuits that are malformed, right? And he says that on then bringing it back to the conception of freedom, these things are ultimately unfree, both in the sense that we just mentioned with Augustine, because the person is subject to these in the grip of disordered desire, but also because they mask the destruction that takes place to one's neighbor.
Yes.
So Francis has this, I think it's in Evangelii Gaudium, he has this great discussion in which he says how it is that we lament and have news items dedicated to the reduction at a couple of points on the stock market.
Yes.
And yet we'll walk past the destitute, the poor, the completely dying old and so on.
But and even that is justified on the basis. So if you think about Kavanaugh's incredibly scathing about economic practices of manufacturing, manufacturers and things like that, particularly in the developing world, where we have like sweatshops where $50 t-shirts are paying 15 cents for the workers to produce them and things like that. So for kind of laissez-faire capitalist ideologues, they would say, well, the person in the sweatshop is exercising their freedom, right?
Yeah.
They're choosing to work there.
Contract.
Even though their choice is between that and prostitution or starvation or selling their children in for God knows what. But that's a choice, right? That's freedom and that's the organizing principle of our society. But that cannot be freedom unless it is in line with some sort of objective end for human life. And that is the very thing that consumerism seeks to dissolve. Mm. There is no end.
Yeah, so there's that's I think really important and interesting that freedom here is actually it's not just about I'm subject to wrongly disordered desire. But my wrongly disordered desire means the unfreedom, as it were, of other persons, right? And that this is not the absence of religion, but it's some other forms of religiosity. Mm. And that goes to the second point you're raising, where it's saying cultivating desire and so on, is that there's something post-material here, yes, right? In which that there's both a good, hopeful indicator perhaps. People desire something perhaps, but it's malformed.
Yes. So Kavanaugh reckons that consumerism is kind of close to Christianity in some ways because it seeks to transcend the material in a certain way, in the sense that a lot of Christian, classical Christian theology would
and
also say.
And like probably contrary Marx. So Marx says a lot for us here.
Yeah.
As in he'll talk about the exchange value of a product being unrelated to its material value, right, being uncoupled from its materiality. Yep. And how persons, for Marx, come to occupy sort of symbolic allegories because you become a laborer who consumes goods, right, as opposed to somebody who's engaged in the exchange and use of this product, right, mutual with mutually producing it together. And but Marx is interested in this in part because he then, it's almost like trying to get to the real materiality of the good, right? Whereas what you'd probably say here is, no, we go beyond that and say, no, goods have always been about more than just simply the material exchange. They always have, participated in forming a community.
Yeah, and they have symbolic meaning.
Symbolic meaning. So gift economies, right? They sustain forms of solidarity amongst people. Mm. And so the question is then, how do you cultivate a sense in which people want kind of like a post-material conception, want their goods to maybe mean something more than just simply this is a material thing for consumption, into a manner that is actually for the good.
Yeah. And so he has a really interesting, one of the things he says about consumerism is, contrary to kind of popular discourse, the problem with consumerism is that it's not materialist enough.
Right.
That is, the matter that is involved in it doesn't matter. It could be anything. So he even talks about how it penetrates our bodies even. And he gives the example of a young student in America who became very famous because he leased out his forehead to have a advertising for a, I think it was like a sleep apnea mask, tatted across his head for 30 days. And his justification was that for that was, well, this is some property that I own. Yeah. It's not being used. And so why not make some money out of it? And there you can see our most intimate experience of ourselves, that is, as embodied agents, there is just another commodity for exchange. It's exchangeable on the market like, I don't know, a side of beef or...
I think we discussed this before, how in this way capitalism and liberalism is sort of like in hand, because you've got an understanding that what determines value is the ascription of value by individual will.
Yes. And right? then even the body itself becomes an object of ownership, which is a bizarre way of thinking about it, right? Because the body is not analogous with any other objects, because you can't conceive of your existence as separated from your body.
Right.
And there's parallels here with things like the commodification of sex or the sex industry and things like that, that the most deeply personal, intimate expression of our selfhood could be turned into a commodity for exchange on the market or leased out for any number of different purposes in different ways.
So there is, when you're saying as well that the materiality doesn't matter, and I immediately also think of, the increasing move towards sort of cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah.
And that money itself becomes a transcendental signifier.
That's
that
right.
It sort of floats free and ethereal.
It doesn't point to any object in the world.
And it's, to be acquired and sort of numbers on a page sort of stuff. And that can have an absence then of fellowship or fellow feeling, because it can mask what is taking place in that exchange, right? If you're doing currency exchanges across the entire across countries, right, then it's very difficult to actually see the very materiality of an exchange taking place that may be something that is about solidarity with that person who's produced that good.
Or even think about our basic experience of being earthbound creatures. So one of the problems with consumerism is that it is kind of a perpetuating system that is iterative and feeds itself and expands and expands and expands until it's actually now breaching the limits of a habitable planet. And one of the technocratic solutions to this problem is, well, we just engineer the planet. Like the givenness of being creatures that is bound to a particular earthly sphere, that itself can be changed, manipulated, and shifted to suit our patterns of consumption. So we don't change our patterns of consumption. We change our environment to make it amenable to our endless desire for more things. I think that is the most Gnostic move imaginable. What it's declaring is that creation is not good. The limitations that creation puts on us, the limitations it puts on our bodies, the limitations it puts on our relationship to the landscape around us, those things are evils that need to be overcome. And this is in stark contrast to a Judeo-Christian understanding of creation is fundamentally a place of abundance.
Yeah, right. So
where there is enough.
And yeah, exactly, there's enough. So it's about abundance in the sense of right distribution.
Yes.
Right, so it's about the perpetual sharing amongst people. So the Eucharistic feast is not, you know, it's not a scarce good. It's not limited to one person who goes, oh, I'll have a little bit more of yours, please.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll take yours. Oh, glug, glug, take it all down sort of thing, right? Yeah. It's actually because it is rightly distributed amongst people. And so it becomes the community that is operating together with its gifts and sharing and so on. So then this raises a question for me. So we've just touched on how it doesn't take materiality seriously in the sense of bodies, or it doesn't take the fellowship of persons seriously and the freedom of an individual to pursue right ends. You know, when we say that the offshore, you know, person who's working a sweatshop, they're supposedly free and so on. But there's something right still about people wanting goods to not just be about consumption in the sense of like that was good, that satisfied, that filled my energy quota.
Yes.
So when you read this, like when I read Being Consumed and so on, you know, it precipitates all those questions about so what? So I mean, when you went through it, what did you?
So Kavanaugh,
I find this very difficult.
Yeah, like, so
we were talking about this earlier, right? Just to put it out there, I find it very difficult, some of this conversation, because often it turns into, okay, so you should be eating less meat and things like this. Yes. And maybe that's true. But I also am one of these people that thinks, you know, recycling is like pissing in the wind unless there is actually law and political authority that tells us that actually coordinates us towards a end of environmental protection.
Yeah, I mean, I'd point you on that point. That's a fascinating point of moral psychology, and I'd point you to I think last week's Mindfield episode was on this topic, right?
Right.
Is it ever worth doing something where your individual contribution will not have any kind of net effect on the world? When is it? Why and how is it worthwhile, for example, turning off your lights when you leave the room, knowing that for all intents and purposes, that's done nothing? I think that's a fascinating conversation, right? And I think it doesn't quite do justice to our identity as collective communal creatures. And we need to be not in a Kantian universalizing sense, but acknowledging that I'm acting as a member of a society when I do these things. One big point is, so I read this book and I felt incredibly, guilty about my patterns of consumption because I love these horrible corporate stuff like Disney products and things like that. And then also just generally, I don't put much thought into what I eat. and all these types of things. My one concrete decision after talking to Sarah was, well, let's start by trying to change one thing in my life that has some sort of positive impact, and that happened to be rain, hail, or shine, no meat for one day of the week kind of thing. Now, that's tokenistic and pissing in the wind, maybe. It's also kind of maybe a bit of a bourgeois luxury and things like that. But I think the moral formation part is not inconsequential. Mm. But that's not just it. We also need to be fighting for regulation, regulation of the way in which meat, animals are reared and butchered and things like that. We need action on climate, but we basically need to reject any attempts at solving global issues around both the denigration of the climate, but also the poisoning of the oceans, for example, the introduction of microplastics into things like that. We have to be rejecting any notion that we can solve these.
Just about tea bags.
Yeah. we have to reject any notion that sees it as possible of solving these problems without actually consuming less as a people, right? And this is the big sticking point on any action around these issues.
It takes real change.
Like one podcast that I love listening to is doing a fundraiser at the moment for basically a belt of seaweed that's going around the world that apparently will draw in carbon emissions and things like that. And I think to myself, that's a nice kind of nice attempt at doing something like that. But the function of those kinds of little projects in people's mind is that, oh, thank God I can keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, right.
And there's some solution. There's always some, I think Byron, our friend who has his podcast, The Good Dirt, he talks about it as, I think, silver bullet solutions. Yeah. There'll be some technocratic solution to that will allow us to continue our patterns of consumption.
Yeah, and I think you're right about moral. I mean, I think, yes, the moral formation of the person then has consequences for how they want political formation. So if we even think of the common good as a coordinating of one's individual good with our commonality, then you need to have some operations on both, I think. I mean, and there are other things as well. Obviously, you know, so Blue Labor, for example, talks about this a bit with having localized finance that is invested in local production.
Yeah.
The idea being that then you in your local area will support that local production. You know the worker, you know the butcher, you know this, you know, they're part of the community. And so actually it's about re-embedding our, in Carl Polanyi's terms, re-embedding our economic relations into the social as the dominant thing rather than the economic being the dominant.
And Kavanaugh sees the Eucharist as a kind of symbol of that kind of solidarity, right? Because it's always a particular Eucharistic instance happening, but it's a global meal. So it's marrying the universal and the particular together. And as I kind of gather around the Eucharist and kneel and receive from the body and blood of Christ, I myself am being called to be consumed and taken up into the person of Christ and have my solidarity with the people who I'm sharing the kneeling cushion with. I'm meant to be orientating myself towards them through participation in this symbol of the superabundance of the universe and rejection of scarcity as the underlying principle.
Actually, yes, I mean, I think it's important to add with moral formation there in that context. It's not just my work, as in there is actually something transformative that takes place.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just about out of time. We've got a little event to plug. So, speaking of Kavanaugh.
So what is it? Let me get the title right. The title of this conference, Many Old Gods, Disenchantment and Idolatry in the Modern World, an academic conference with Professor William T. Kavanaugh. So our friends over at the Institute for Ethics and Society and the School of Philosophy and Theology at Notre Dame in Sydney here
hosting a conference with Kavanagh is actually coming out to Sydney to do a few events, and you'll be speaking at the St. Mary's Cathedral in Sydney, and I think he's actually going out to Fremantle as well if you live out on the Western Australian side of things.
Who else is speaking at this this event, Joe?
Matthew Tan.
Oh, wow.
Matt Tan. Yeah.
I love that guy.
Love that guy. Yeah. Our awkward Asian theologian. Love him. He's speaking, as is Dr. Rachel Gilmore and Professor Renee Kohler-Ryan. And then this kind of, this ringer looks like he should have a shave and a shower.
It's Joel. Joel is speaking.
It's me as well. Speaking, and we're going to be talking about, we're going to be giving papers about Kavanagh's book that's in draft called Many Old Gods, Disenchantment and Idolatry in the Modern World. So if you're interested in that, it will take place on the 13th of November, Wednesday, 13th of November in Sydney. And you should just look up the Notre Dame Institute for Ethics and Society, and you can see all the events they're going to be doing with Kavanagh, who is, as Dave has been discussing as well, he's just a really interesting, challenging theologian to think with as well.
Yeah. So head along to that. Follow us on Facebook. You can search for us, The Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter. That's at UCAT, EUCAT underscore podcast. Please drop us a review on whatever platform you listen to us, and also share us with your friends, and that really helps us to get more exposure. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time as we take a week off next week to record and research. See you then.